Well, again, it's that time of year, and we have been receiving questions from our listeners from last week's announcement that we're going to be doing a question and answer program. We're asking again that listeners would go ahead and send those questions to info@McIlvaney.com.
The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
To ignore risk has been to your advantage repeatedly. And every time the markets came bouncing back, financial conditions loosened again, and it was off to the races. And basically, you were kind of stupid if you paid attention to risk. So it's not confusing to me today why the markets are ignoring risk, because it's paid dividends repeatedly. I just think this time it's a trap, and a lot of people are unprepared for what is unfolding.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, my 31st Christmas party, ICA Christmas party with the McIlvaney family, you know, it's been going on for 46 years, though, so actually I'm still a newcomer.
Yeah, 47. We're in our 47th year. Oh. I think about the year that we're in and the year that we're celebrating. So, yeah, the 38th year for one employee, 36 for another, 32, two at 31, and this year we had a special honoring for four of our employees that are now at the 20-year mark.
20 years.
I mean, it's a remarkable opportunity to work with remarkable people, and you feel so differently about going to work when you love the people that you work with and have a tremendous amount of respect for them. And it just, you know, it really is something special.
You know, it was interesting because it's such a multi-generational company. My son was there at the party, and he was talking to my wife saying, you know, this is one of the best ICA parties that I've ever been at. Your son sat and talked to me. He's 12. And I looked over at your wife and I said, you know, this is strange for me because it was about that time that I came to the company. You were about 12 years old when I came to the company. So what a blessing. I mean, it really is amazing.
Well, today we're going to visit with Doug Noland. And Doug joined us here in the last few years after spending 25, 30 years working in the hedge fund arena and mutual fund space, managing short exposures, managing foreign currencies, managing all kinds of different portfolios.
Well, and we were reading his work while he was doing that. You know, he was not connected to the company, but we here loved to read the Credit Bubble Bulletin.
And before that, the Rishabasher letter, which mm-hmm. he was helping to publish there in the late 90s. So, you know, Wednesday is an interesting day for us. Wednesday, the markets are closed in honor to George H.W. Bush. And my wife was playing tennis in Houston years ago. This is when she was still in high school. A man walks onto the court and challenges them to a match. So there is this vigorous volley that ensues, two against one, and he's kind, he's gentlemanly. This is George H.W. He's thanking them for the
she
game.
She got a chance to meet him.
Yeah, they played some tennis, and the Bush family office was just around the corner from the tennis courts, and he would play there. I met him only once. I met him years later at the grand opening gala for the Hobby Center there in Houston. But that's why the markets are closed here on Wednesday. We've had a tremendous amount of volatility the last week or two, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to visit with Doug, because he's got some interesting insights. Doug Noland, you're joining us today to bring some insight into what has been some incredibly volatile weeks. 2 weeks ago, the market was in steep decline. Last Wednesday, that began to change, and we had the largest weekly rally in the S&P and the NASDAQ since 2011. And you were noting that, you know, we had the 3.8% decline the previous week. The S&P then rallied 4.8% last week. The Dow surged 5.2%. The transports were up 4.4%. The banks rose 3.6%. And the broader market somewhat underperformed. Across the board, we've got this rally going on. The NASDAQ 100 surged 6.5% last week. Semiconductors recovered 5.1%. And then some of your high-profile short stocks were off the charts. As you noted, Amazon surged 12.5%, NVIDIA 12.7%, Netflix 10.6%, and it goes on and on. What last week, and even into the early part of this week, was fueling the market's optimism?
Hi, David. Nice to be on with you today. I'm not even sure if it's optimism. You know, at important junctures in the market, and, you know, that's where we think this is going. We think we're transitioning from, you know, a huge bull market to a bear market. You get this wild volatility, a lot of indecision, a lot of speculative trading. I think we've seen recently at least a couple of bouts of significant shorting and hedging. We had the midterm election, then we had the big G20 meeting. You had a lot of traders positioning ahead of those. And so we've seen some big short squeezes, and we've seen big unwinds of hedges. People get on the wrong side of trades, and the market reverses on them, and they're forced to almost panic to reverse their either their shorts or get out of their hedges. We saw that going into Argentina in the day after, and we saw it with the midterms also. We were a big rally into the midterms, big up day the day after the midterms, and then selling commenced again. And bear market rallies are notorious for being ferocious. And, you know, that's the way it's looked so far. I don't see a lot to be bullish about from either the midterms or Argentina. I think the markets would like to believe, at least as far as U.S. and Chinese trade tensions go, that, you know, some of that tension has been relieved, and maybe the risk of tough trade rhetoric and negative headlines has been reduced for a bit. But, you know, the jury's very much out on what was actually decided or agreed to in Argentina.
Well, Doug, your job's not an easy one. You know, the markets up and down and this kind of volatility is a real challenge. We look at all bear markets and they begin as corrections. So here we are, not in bear market territory in big indexes, but certainly you've got a number of stocks, 3, 4, almost 500 stocks out of the 2,000 that are listed on the New York Stock Exchange, which have declined from 20 to 90%. So there are some companies that have really taken it on the chin. If this is a Santa Claus rally, it's not inconsistent with what we saw in the year 2000 and the year 2007 coming into significant market declines. What we do now characterize as some of the worst bear markets had a nice little Santa Claus pop there at the end of the year. So I guess we can't rule that out. One of the things I think we take for granted is stability. Has there ever been a period where financial markets were stable? I think that's one of the questions I have for you. And are we at the point where, you know, 3 to 5% weekly swings, how do we understand stability and financial stability in this kind of volatile market environment?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And, you know, I've been in the markets going back to 1990, and for me, I haven't seen a lot of stability. It's been, you know, serial booms and busts going back to the early 1990s. I mean, you could start, you know, with 1987 and the boom and bust in 87 and then follow the cycles all the way to where we are now. And if anything, I think these bull cycles have just gotten longer and more speculative, which creates a lot of inherent instability. The belief is that the markets are stable as long as they're going up and financial conditions remain loose. But the instability kind of lies in wait for financial conditions to tighten, for speculative excess to turn to, you know, risk aversion, de-risking, deleveraging. So it's an interesting discussion right now that the Fed last week issued their first report on financial stability. And it's interesting just to look at the Fed provided their own definition of what they see as financial stability. And I'll just reference it here. To the Fed, a stable financial system, when hit by adverse events or shocks, continues to meet the demands of households and businesses for financial services, such as credit provisions, payment services, etc. So the Fed believes they're dealing with a very stable financial system. It's important to them to have financial stability. But I would argue that there's a lot of inherent instability, because what we believe is stability only continues as long as the markets boom, financial conditions remain really loose, and everyone remains optimistic. And that's just not the way market cycles work.
Well, and I guess that gets to maybe a more philosophical question. You know, we have a Fed, and maybe the Jay Powell Fed is different than those that preceded it. But market cycles, you and I understand that there's boom and bust, and that's normal. That's normal. So financial market stability, if they're saying that somehow this can be a managed process and you can avoid having radical ups and downs, are we dealing with a totally different framework? And is that framework something that's even realistic?
Why? I think this is a completely different framework than we've dealt with historically. I've argued over the years that, you know, we've had a huge momentous change in contemporary finance to where we have market-driven credit, market-driven finance, as opposed to the old way it worked, where bank credit kind of drove the credit and economic cycles. So these cycles, to me, are inherently unstable because when the markets are booming, finance is too loose, markets turn too speculative, and it's self-reinforcing for these long, big up cycles. The markets believe that central banks can master the cycle and not allow the down cycle. The markets believe that central bankers learned from the last crisis. But I believe, this cycle has led to only a greater bubble, and these bubbles inevitably burst. And that's part of the framework here that we're dealing with, what really is a highly, highly unstable system that somehow poses as financial stability as long as things are going well.
So let's roll the clock back to last week, Wednesday, a week ago from today. Jay Powell and his team looking at what variables they were, and maybe you have an idea of what they were looking at, because there was a shift in their verbiage. There was a shift in their views from their October statement. And the big difference was, we're a long way from neutral. That was their message in October. And then their message last week is, we're just below neutral. There's a big difference, and I wonder what maybe they saw. Dig into the Fed comments for us.
Sure, and I'll start by saying Jay Powell, I think his comments were misinterpreted somewhat, where he did not specifically say his view had changed from October to now. He wasn't saying that we're now close to neutral. What he was saying was, we're getting close to the range of neutrals within the committee. But clearly the Fed has turned more dovish. They're now saying, I think they would argue that the neutral rate has come down, and that's fine. Let's think to where we were back in October. I believe it was October 3rd when Chairman Powell said that we're still a long ways from neutral. Well, at that point, if you think of it, we were almost 3 years into a Fed tightening cycle, a mild one at that, but 3 years, yet credit conditions remained very loose. The stock market was basically at all-time highs, and GDP forecasts were running at about 4% U.S. economic growth. So you could argue at that point that, the Fed was going to have to continue to raise significantly to get to some point where their policies were restraining growth. Well, now the markets reversed between now and what we saw back in October. So all of a sudden, financial conditions have tightened significantly, and that's corporate credit. GDP expectations have downshifted. We're seeing weaknesses in some areas of the economy. So the environment has changed dramatically since early October in the markets. And I believe the markets dictate economic performance. So now the Fed has to backtrack from where they were before. But I think this whole concept of the neutral rate is problematic, because I think they just used it to justify keeping rates low for almost a decade. And now they're kind of stuck trying to use it during normalization or during volatile market periods. And it's just not going to function very well, because there's not a real neutral rate out there. It's mythical.
Well, this has been confusing to me, because, when I read Knut Wicksell, the Swedish economist, and he talked about the neutral rate, it was like something that the market figured out, and you knew kind of more or less where it was, because that's where bonds traded, and that's where, but it didn't have to do with assigning a particular number, if that makes sense. Is it based on market conditions? Is it purely economic data? Is this something that they choose conveniently to be able to place interest rates where they want, and then they just have the language of neutral rates to give them some, bearing above or below? What's the bogey? Are we over? Are we under?
Yeah, and the way I've looked at this, the old debate back with Knut Wicksell, it was a different economic structure, a different financial structure. And to make this simplistic, it was banks lending to industry for capital investment. That was the driving force for credit growth and for economic expansion. Well, in the industrial sector, there were profits and there was a return on investment. And basically, they would borrow to the point where their debt service costs matched the returns on their investment. So there was a self-adjusting process where the cost of borrowing would rise until it met the declining return on investment in the real economy. So you could sit there and you could kind of try to decipher what the neutral rate was. Well, this system today is totally different, because, again, you have the market driving credit growth. You have markets driving interest rates, and there's no self-adjusting process because we have unlimited finance. And as we've seen, you know, governments can borrow, corporations can borrow enormous amounts, and interest rates don't rise because we just create more finance. So that's the framework I see where the neutral rate doesn't work today as it would have in a much simpler economic and financial system.
So you mentioned the Federal Reserve's framework for monitoring financial stability, their Wednesday presentation. And they talk about one of the items in there was funding risk. They talk about funding risk. They don't appear all that concerned with funding risk. Where's the catch?
Yeah, another great question. Unfortunately, I don't believe the Fed learned probably the most important lessons from the mortgage finance bubble period. You have these market risk misperceptions, and they can play a vital role in so-called funding risks. And we don't have to call it funding risk. Let's call it, you know, the risk of a run. That's what it's been historically, and that's what it was in 08. Back during the mortgage finance bubble period, I talked a lot about the moneyness of credit. It was this notion that if something was AAA, and that's, you know, basically trillions of dollars of mortgage-related instruments back then, if it was AAA, it was perceived as safe and liquid, a store of value. It was perceived money-like, and that's always dangerous because if something's perceived money-like, you can issue enormous amounts of it, which leads to distortions in the financial sector and the economy, etc. Well, what we've seen during this cycle, it's almost a decade long now, we saw central banks slash rates, massive QE, liquidity injections, and I've referred to the moneyness of risk assets. They fostered perceptions in the marketplace that risk assets basically don't have much risk anymore, that they're money-like. You can send your money into an index fund. You can buy investment-grade corporate credit. It doesn't matter. It's all liquid. The Fed will ensure we don't lose money, so there's not a lot of risk. Well, I'm sorry. Crises almost always unfold in the money markets or where there's this misperception of risk. And that's the risk today in risk assets. And, you know, the easy examples are equity and corporate credit ETFs, where trillions have flowed into these funds believing they can get out at any point and that they can't lose much money. And you could have a serious run on these types of funds if people get scared. And there's a lot of funds that own illiquid assets, especially in corporate credit, and that's where you can have a real problem. If you had a run on corporate ETFs and then the underlying funds have to try to liquidate corporate bonds, they can be very illiquid in good markets and can be completely illiquid in poorly trading markets. So, yeah, I think the Fed really underestimates the risk of runs on these risk asset funds that have proliferated during this boom.
We had a central banker from the Bank of England on the program maybe a year or two ago, Charles Goodhart. And, you know, we were talking about debt and, you know, quantities of debt that a central bank could take onto their balance sheet. And in this paper that we've been talking about from the Fed sees that tariffs and debt, these are real deal issues. And that's what they've said. Well, one of those is an exogenous or external threat, the tariffs. They can't control that. They can't control the Twitter feed. They don't know what's going to happen with the Chinese or with NAFTA as it's being redrafted as we speak. These are things that exogenously they can't control. Then the endogenous risk, the debt issue. The reason I bring Charles Goodhart back into the conversation is because he said, look, we'll just sterilize it. And you know, this past period, the last 10 years, you just mentioned the idea of monetizing debt and QE programs. Is it possible that they kind of put debt out there as a straw man issue where they're not actually really concerned about it because they know they have a balance sheet that can expand? And as Goodhart said, I don't even know what he meant by that. We'll just sterilize it.
Yeah, I would say that's a sign of the times. You know, there are a number of problems with monetization. We can look at financial history, but I would say one of the big, big problems with monetization is it works. Or more accurately, it appears to work for a while. But, you know, it's always been, and I think this time, a big trap. We've seen it throughout history. It used to be called inflationism. And once you go down this road, it becomes very difficult to get off of it, you know, because you can monetize debt, you can add liquidity to the system, but your system becomes only more dependent upon ongoing inflation. These rising price levels in the economy and the asset markets, they get elevated. And this economy, this structure becomes increasingly distorted, and the system becomes acutely vulnerable to any slowing of credit growth. You know, we're starting to see signs of this globally, certainly in China. So then if you have this credit slowdown, that risks bursting asset and speculative bubbles while exposing a large number of uneconomic enterprises that flourish during the inflationary period. This is, again, this is part of economic cycles that go way back. But the key part of the analysis, I think, is prolonging the inflation, and that's credit inflation. Prolonging the boom only extends what I call the terminal phase of bubble excess. So you have greater financial and economic maladjustment and fragility. Your bubble just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that's where we are today. It's been growing for a decade. And if central banks want to come in and continue to monetize, okay, well, when does this stop? And what do they expect down the road as far as market perceptions, as far as the soundness of all this credit that's created? You know, Japan has that problem now, right? They can't turn off the spigot. They just keep monetizing government deficits, and where it stops, nobody knows. But at the end of the day, that credit is not good credit. The central bank balance sheet's impaired. The Japanese government balance sheet's heavily impaired. And it gets back to the issue we spoke about earlier of financial stability, or more accurately, you know, inherent instability of all this monetary inflation.
I think this last week is really instructive, and I hope our listeners will really clue into this. One of the reasons I asked you to join us for a couple of minutes today is because, you know, on the one hand, Wednesday last week up into the early part of this week, the stock market just was on a tear, going straight through the roof. And yet the credit markets continue to send a different signal than the equity markets. You've got equities are ebullient. Credit still seems concerned, which is consistent with what led into the Fed, you know, suggesting that maybe we're at a different place. You know, we won't see hikes in 2019, and maybe we're closer to neutral. That's the consensus view. What are the credit markets telling us? And was there a misread last week in the equity markets by equity traders?
Right. And these two markets play very different games, especially at the end of a cycle. And, you know, we saw very similar dynamics back in 07, where the mortgage finance bubble was actually pierced in the summer of 2007 with, you know, the blowups in subprime. And that started to lead to a tightening, obviously, of mortgage credit, but also some tightening of corporate credit. And the credit markets turned risk averse, increasingly risk averse. But at the same time, that led to, you know, a collapse in treasury yields, in this perception in the stock market that the speculative cycle could continue to run, because the stock market's not focused on fundamentals. It's become a very speculative game, and you can get really wild moves at the end of the cycle. You can make a lot of money at the end of the cycle, and that's kind of the focus of stocks. And when you see market yields go down, you think you're going to get another bite of the apple in equities. And that's kind of the way the stock market has traded recently, where the credit market is saying the cycle has turned. And even last week with big rally in equities, there was no rally in corporate credit. Corporate credit remained nervous. But equities, you know, okay, we'll get the Santa Claus rally. We can make a quick 10%. And you get this divergence between these two markets. And that divergence is problematic. And over time, I would put my faith in the analysis of the credit markets, because they have more of a long-term focus than I would the real short-term focused speculative stock market. And, you know, so we've seen it all before. It doesn't make it easy to play as an investment manager, but it's not that confusing when you see markets act like this late cycle.
So earlier you were talking about ETFs and both equity and corporate debt inside the ETF structure. What are the volumes telling us in those ETF flows?
Yeah, the flows into corporate credit remained more resilient than I would have expected this year, but they've turned, and we're now seeing outflows. We're seeing outflows from the junk funds. We're also seeing outflows from the investment grade funds. So that's a real change in the marketplace. What we don't see, we don't have transparency to see what the hedge funds are doing. I'm assuming that they're unwinding leverage in the corporate credit market, where I believe there is significant leverage. We've seen spreads widen. We've seen the cost of insuring the credit default swap market. We've seen the price of that insurance rise. So we're seeing a lot of signals that the cycle has turned in corporate credit. I think the big outflows will come as we get further along in the cycle, but we're seeing cracks today.
Well, so run through a hypothetical scenario where you're segment of investment grade paper, BBB, comes under pressure from the rating agencies. You got $2.5 trillion in this BBB category out of $9 trillion that's in the corporate credit sector. What happens should it be downgraded?
Right, and that's a very pertinent question. It's almost not even hypothetical at this point. For our listeners, the first thing to remember is credit is self-reinforcing. That's the nature of credit. So there's some inherent instability in credit, right? That's why you have these booms. In credit, everything looks fine as long as financial conditions remain loose. And in corporate credit, as long as funds continue to flow into, let's say, credit ETFs and the hedge funds continue to want to leverage, then credit availability is very loose. And even the poor credits, even the really risky junk borrowers, can easily borrow money, refinance debt, do whatever they want, right? So the markets overlook a lot of things when financial conditions are loose. We've had this interesting dynamic in the markets where we've had an incredible boom in BBB rated corporate debt. And that's basically the riskiest tranche of investment grade debt. And why have you had a boom there? Because there's been all of this money just flooding into investment grade mutual funds, ETF in particular, and those funds have gone out and they've had to buy corporate credit and they like to get a higher yield. So they've been aggressively lending to the riskier investment grade credits. And everything works great as long as the credit continues to flow, finance continues to flow, the global economy continues to grow, the U.S. economy expands, etc. Well, I'm sorry, that dynamic has changed. I believe the global bubble is pierced. Financial conditions have tightened dramatically globally. We've seen the emerging markets, we've seen 20% stock market decline in China, et cetera, a real tightening of corporate finance globally that will usher in weaker global growth. And now U.S. corporate credit has finally been hit by this contagion, which impacted the periphery months ago. So now credit conditions have tightened in the U.S., so all of a sudden credit is not as easily available. It is tightened up. The economy now will slow. And a lot of these risky credits, these triple Bs, will now be at risk of being downgraded to junk. And if they're downgraded from junk, that means the investment grade funds that own them can't own them anymore. They have to sell them. It's not clear who's going to buy them. So that leads us to believe credit conditions will tighten even more dramatically with an impact on the economy. And what we'll see is the downside of the credit cycle. And we're seeing a significant widening in credit spreads at General Electric. What that means, the market's getting nervous about General Electric, one of the big issuers of BBB credit. The worry is General Electric could be a junk issuer before too long. And that means the market for their debt will be difficult at best. And then the markets will worry about, can GE continue to borrow money? And if they can't, what is the prognosis for that company going forward? What is the prognosis for other high-risk borrowers now that may lose access to borrowings, much as subprime lost access back in 2007. So that's kind of a long-winded answer as far as what we're seeing start to unfold in corporate credit right now.
Well, you started by saying that credit is self-reinforcing. And in the midst of that explanation, you were also describing the structure of those financial products, which doesn't accommodate large amount of liquidation. So mutual funds and ETFs are not structured to be as liquid as they are perceived. You can't turn around and sell billions and billions and billions of dollars of ETF and mutual funds without there being a self-reinforcing negative price dynamic, which again puts a lot of those companies under pressure and certainly puts the segment for investors in a point of real pain. My next question deals with, what kind of circumstances do you think would be there for a downgrade? Or do we have them already?
Yeah, and in touching upon your last comments, David, back during the mortgage finance bubble period, I referred to the alchemy of finance, this Wall Street alchemy of transforming endless risky mortgage loans into perceived safe and liquid AAA rated mortgage paper. Well, that works during the boom, but then the misperceptions there come back to haunt the system when all of a sudden the holders of those perceived money-like instruments all of a sudden realize they're holding a lot of risk that they don't want to hold. And they start to try to dump them. And that's that run scenario that we referred to earlier. At the beginning of every year for my Credit Bubble Bulletin, I have the issues for that year. And my issues 2018, I titled it Market Structure, because I have a real problem for this alchemy of finance where we've transformed all of these risky risk assets, corporate debt, equities, into perceived safe and liquid ETF shares in particular. That's a real problem. You don't want to have a big gulf between perceptions of safety and the reality of a lot of risk, liquidity risk, price risk, etc. The downgrades come as soon as system finance, as soon as credit starts to tighten, then the riskier borrowers lose access to finance, and that changes the cycle. And you always have this contagion where, like, one country or one company loses access to finance and gets in trouble, and then the markets not only lose some there, they want to look ahead and get out of the way of the next vulnerable country, market, or company. And that leads to contagion. And what we've been seeing is, again, the contagion started at the periphery of the global bubble in the emerging markets. Now it's made it to the core here in U.S. corporate credit. And that's why I think people should take this very seriously, because the dynamics that we're used to over the past decade of loose credit, they're changing now. So that changes the prognosis for the economy and certainly for a lot of the riskier borrowers in the marketplace.
Well, that leads me to the next question, which deals with the ECB. The European Central Bank is stopping the CSPP, the Corporate Sector Purchase Program, and they've put, I don't know, $150, $170 billion into corporate paper. I mean, losing access. We're talking about European companies which have been subsidized by the European Central Bank. Pricing is distorted, yields are cheaper, and the ECB is saying, we, the artificial buyer in the market, are stepping back. Is that enough to create that sort of contagion effect and impact into the U.S. corporate credit markets because of the ECB stopping the CSPP program?
Right, exactly. And I'm going to sound arrogant here, and I don't like to. I've been humbled in the markets for so many years that I can't believe I could sound arrogant. But this whole notion of central banks reflating whatever it takes to reflate, you know, trillions of dollars of liquidity just thrown into the marketplace like this, it's foolhardy. And why it's so dangerous is, and we've seen it in Europe, all of a sudden when the ECB is going to monetize, when they're going to add the liquidity, they're going to buy corporates, they're going to buy government debt, they're going to buy Italian debt. Well, the speculators in the marketplace, what do you want to own? Why not own Italian debt? Because they're going to give you a higher yield. You can make more money during the upside of the cycle. Why not buy debt of European banks? Why not buy just European debt generally? So everything looks great again. Credit self-reinforcing, speculative bubbles are self-reinforcing. Well, when things change, as we've seen with the global bubble being pierced and tighter financial conditions, where does the market fear? Oh, the marginal borrower, Italy, European banks, European corporates, right? So that's where you see the big reversal of speculative flows, and you see all the problems unfold. And the problems in Italy today are worse than they were before, because they've had years of just more deficit spending and lack of structural adjustment. The European banks are just as fragile or more than before. You know, the issues were not resolved. And the question is, how does this make it? What is the link between Europe and U.S. corporates? Well, for one, you have hedge funds, for example, that have been big players in higher yielding European debt. They now have losses. They're unwinding positions in Europe. They have to be more risk averse. So they need to take risk off in the U.S. markets also. Again, this is part of contagion. So now the hedge funds are de-risking, deleveraging in U.S. corporate credit. Credit conditions are tightening. So, you know, global dynamics started in, let's say, the emerging markets, made it to Europe, and then, you know, moved from Europe into the U.S. And it's just part of this global bubble dynamic that, you know, I've been writing about for years, and everybody has ignored it for years because it hasn't mattered. But now it matters because global financial conditions are tight.
All right. So, you know, the world is complex. We've got lots of things going on. Obviously, the credit markets underscore the expansion of assets. And, you know, we've been talking about that. In recent weeks, I've been working through a couple of books on Richard Cantillon and John Law. And one of the things that the author noted is the South Sea Company was a market leader. And Cantillon, who was a banker at that time, he said that the sine qua non, the most essential aspect for maintaining a rising market, was an expansion in credit. And lo and behold, the ending of that bubble period was when credit began to contract, and all of a sudden the South Sea stock couldn't be maintained at those levels. We have a confluence of negative returns today across asset classes. Deutsche Bank did a study where 90% of 70 different asset classes they were looking at, 70 different asset classes, negative in terms of their rate of return through mid-November. This is a lot of red that we're talking about, and I don't feel like the attitude in the market has shifted at all. There doesn't seem to be a lot of concern. In fact, you know, if we want to transition from that to looking at what happened over the weekend, the working dinner in Buenos Aires, we get a lot of enthusiasm coming out of that. The equity markets in Europe and in Asia, they are giddy with Xi and Trump accomplishing, what did they accomplish? They've got a 90-day postponement of the fireworks. They're going to work on things. So nothing bad's going to happen immediately. But the market liked it. I just don't see the market having any real sensitivity to declines which have already occurred and to what you're talking about in terms of a shrinking of available credit. If credit conditions are tightening, and we know from history that it is credit expansion which drives an increase in asset prices, why is there not more concern in the marketplace today?
There should be. The way this is unfolding so far, for me, it provides a lot of confirmation in the thesis. You know, and I argued starting back in 2009, I started warning about the unfolding global government finance bubble. And this bubble could be fueled by a historic expansion of central bank credit and government debt. And that's basically the heart of global money and credit. And I never imagined it would get to this point. But we've seen, you know, tens of trillions of dollars of central bank credit and sovereign debt growth, right? So it's been global. It's been across countries, regions. It's been across asset markets, risk assets, perceived safe assets, you know, government debt. So what we're seeing in the marketplace now, and why I'm saying the global bubble has been pierced, is we're seeing weakness almost across the board, across asset classes, something very unusual in markets. I think it's very problematic because for a lot of reasons, there's been a proliferation of strategies. Risk parity is one that people talk about, where these are leverage strategies where you can have corporate bonds, you can have equities, of course, commodities, and then, you know, you can hedge them with a big chunk of, let's say, treasury debt. And for years now, we've seen any potential nervousness in the market, you get a big rally in treasury debt, and that offsets any weakness you've seen in the other asset classes. Well, now we've seen dynamics where, you know, losses across asset classes, and that's going to force a lot of these leveraged players to de-risk and de-leverage these strategies. So it's an important part of the market dynamic. At the same time, we have highly speculative markets, as we've talked about. There's a big belief that markets will rally. And why would the markets believe that? Why would markets discount what we're talking about, David? Because that's paid dividends for almost a decade, right? To ignore risk has been to your advantage repeatedly, right? We had almost a crisis back in 2011 with the Fed's exit strategy talk. We had almost a crisis in 2012 with the big unwind, potential unwind in Europe. We had the 2015-2016 scare in China and the emerging markets. And every time the markets came bouncing back, financial conditions loosened again and it was off to the races. And basically, you were kind of stupid if you paid attention to risk. So it's not confusing to me today why the markets are ignoring risk, because it's paid dividends repeatedly. I just think this time it's a trap and a lot of people are unprepared for what is unfolding.
Well, in the midst of the market gyrations, we also have geopolitical issues swirling. We've got Russia, Ukraine, the Iranian ballistic missile tests, which last week were in violation of UN Security Code Regulation 2231. You've got domestic political issues there in France with fuel protests turning violent. And if you want to hop on a train in downtown Paris, I don't think you're going to get anywhere. And to me, it's all summed up with a single word, cusp. Cusp. And that may not be the first word that comes to your mind, but so many things are on the cusp with surprise being a growing probability. When you're on the cusp of something, whether it's a joke or a particular insight or whatever it is, you have people assuming that they're one way. And then all of a sudden, in an instant, it's revealed that it's quite different. Markets like surprise as long as it's positive. They don't like surprise if it's negative. And, you know, I just wonder what is being left out of view. Here we talk about geopolitical issues and these other issues. It's almost as if nothing is as important as getting support from the central bank community. That's really the only thing that seems to register with investors today.
Right. And this has been a very long speculative cycle. So the money has gravitated to the more aggressive managers, and even in business, it's gravitated to the more aggressive business managers. Geopolitical is one, you know, very important risk that if you ignored it, you were better off throughout this whole cycle. We've watched these geopolitical tensions escalate. And a lot of us look at this and say, oh my God, what is unfolding and where is this going to end up? But in the marketplace, if you ignored all of those things, you made more money. So again, the markets have ignored it, but all of a sudden you have this dynamic where these risks start to compound, while in the markets, you have fragility starts to compound. So all of a sudden, if the markets start to falter and all of a sudden the perception in the marketplace is, uh-oh, central banks, maybe they don't have this all under control. Maybe they can't just do more QE and make everything good. So maybe we have to focus on geopolitical. We have to focus on, you know, various risks. Then you've got a very, very different game. And that's how market perceptions can change so quickly late in the cycle, because all of a sudden the markets go from ignoring these risks to all of a sudden saying, oh my God, these are big risks. And again, they think, uh-oh, I thought I was holding something really safe. Now I realize, uh-oh, it's really risky. And that emotional swing can play itself out in the market with a lot of instability. And candidly, that's how panics ensue. And I'm certainly hoping we're not going in that direction, but we've seen all the excesses during this really extreme upcycle that would lead me to fear that kind of outcome is not a low probability event.
You know, the last year, year and a half, as you and I have compared notes multiple times each week, you've been pretty clear that the U.S. economy has been improving, in that your primary concern is within the structure of the financial markets. In the financial markets, you see lots of excess and tremendous over-leverage, whether it's in the corporate sector or certainly in, you know, promoted by governments. On the domestic front here in the U.S., I have to wonder, though, on the economy, we've got pending home sales, which are down. This is the 10th month of annual decreases, according to the National Association of Realtors. We've got October new home sales, which tumbled 8.9%, 4% positive was expected. So a little bit of a reversal there. Auto sales peaked over a year ago. I mean, at what point do you think slowing global growth becomes a U.S. economic growth concern?
Yeah, I've been in the camp for a while now that the U.S. economy was in a boom. And I got a number of emails questioning me on this. And I never said it was sound. Actually, I believe the U.S. economic structure is very unsound. And it's been in this late cycle boom, fueled by loose finance, booming financial markets, asset inflation, and unfortunately, a tremendous amount of malinvestment. So I've seen no good news in the economy as far as, you know, the prognosis for the future. What are we seeing now? We're seeing the inevitable beginning of the end of the upcycle because financial conditions have tightened. Housing, for example. There's an affordability issue, right? Home prices have inflated a lot, which didn't matter as long as the monthly payment was going down because mortgage rates were so low. Well, mortgage rates have gone up, prices are high, monthly payments are much more expensive, there's an affordability issue. I also think there's likely in housing an issue with a significant slowdown in foreign buying, and let's throw out the Chinese. They were buying in certain markets a lot of properties, and I think that has slowed. So not only is there an affordability issue and less foreign demand, you're also seeing a tightening of mortgage credit. I think subprime borrowers now have a much more difficult time getting a reasonably affordable monthly payment than they did 6 months ago. So the cycle's turned. We're seeing it in autos too, a tightening of auto finance. And now, over just recent weeks, we're seeing a more broad-based tightening of corporate credit, which will have important ramifications. And if the markets decline, all of a sudden you're going to see the reversal of this huge growth in household net worth that we've seen over recent years. All of a sudden, if households feel they're poor, as stock prices go down, as potentially home prices go down, they'll pull back on spending, and that's going to be the downside of the economic cycle, and it's not going to be pleasant. I fear the big surprise is we have literally thousands of enterprises out there that have been growing aggressively. They don't make profits. They're negative cash flow companies, but they've been enjoying easy access to finance. You see the commercials all the time on television of all these strange businesses. And I think when finance tightens, we'll see a lot of these companies, they're going to have to fold up shop like we saw back in 2001, 2002. And again, that's what will make this a very difficult economic down cycle. And also throughout last, another comment about bubbles. There's a dynamic when the excesses are conspicuous, like we saw in the tech bubble, then that bubble is generally not as dangerous because the excesses are isolated to one sector. What we've seen during this cycle, it hasn't been as conspicuous because the excesses have been spread, you know, across asset classes, across economies, across business sectors. And unfortunately, I think there's a lot of vulnerability out there that will become more apparent now that finance is not as easy.
And that's something that I've thought about. You know, we don't have, I mean, we did have the kind of conspicuous excess in, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum and Ripple and some of the cryptocurrencies. That was eye-popping. As you said, it's so limited in terms of being a sector that even with its demise or decline here in 2018, it's not as if it's taken the economy down with it. What you're arguing is that this is more of a pervasive bubble. And I wonder if we're not feeling some of that come unwound. Tell me if I've got a misread on this. Wall Street Journal highlighted this last week that 80% of borrowers who refinanced in the third quarter, they chose the cash out option, withdrawing $14.6 billion in equity from their homes. That's the highest share of cash out refinances since 2007. Am I reading too much into that to say that actually the man on the street is looking for liquidity, maybe not to take a vacation, but maybe because he needs liquidity? Correct me if I'm wrong. Am I reading too much into that?
No, I don't think you're reading too much in it at all. And to me, it's just another indication that we're very late cycle. I mean, we've had an echo housing bubble. And if you look at some of the markets, you know, the ones that come to mind, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, and there's some markets on the East Coast as well, where prices have exceeded previous bubble peaks. So nationally, we've had significant price inflation. So there's equity to withdraw from people's inflated home values. And we're at the end of the cycle. Not only do some consumers get stretched and need to tap, you know, that old housing ATM, but you also have more discretionary type spending when people get really optimistic, you know, buy that boat, that trailer, that second home, et cetera. So to me, it's just one more indication of where we are late in the cycle. And also, David, I wanted to touch upon just a little bit more on the economic structure. And if you just think about technology and the huge boom we've seen in technology, a lot of the growth in technology has been selling technology products to other upstarts, has been selling technology to the booming emerging markets, to China. So you could see a situation where the downturn for technology is much more severe today than it was during the previous downturn of, you know, after the 2000 burst of the technology bubble. So we're starting to see some nervousness in technology stocks, but I think there's a lot of tentacles there with this boom in technology, alternative energy, and a lot of the growth industries have been supporting businesses that are uneconomic, economies that are now faltering. So we could see a significant surprise in weakening demand with major impact on the U.S. economy.
You see that with the semiconductors. You know, if you look at NVIDIA, massive increase in accounts receivables. And, you know, from the beginning of October to here recently, down 67%. That's a pretty significant move. $179 billion in market cap to $81 billion in 7 weeks. That suggests that there are segments within technology that when they get hit, seeing an 80 to 90% decline, they may face extinction events, but 80 to 90% is not out of the question. So I'm going to ask you, this is a shameless plug, an absolute shameless plug. So those of you who don't like shameless plugs, you can tune out now. But Tactical Short is your best iteration for what you've been practicing for 25 plus years. Why Tactical Short? Why now?
Well, we believe there are, you know, extreme risks in the marketplace. We think the time to de-risk is upon us here. We're providing a product that we hope can be part of people's portfolios so they can better manage their risk, provide some downside protection, reduce the volatility of their overall portfolio. And basically, You know, we're short the market, but we try to do it tactically. We try to manage the risk more carefully than a lot of these other products available in the marketplace. And we just think it's time for people to sit down and think about how they want to, you know, manage their exposure to not only risk markets, but, you know, their finances generally, and, you know, to get hunkered down for what we think is a rather momentous change in the market cycle here.
Well, appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us, and certainly looking at the corporate credit markets and the divergence between that and what the equities have been saying over the last week or so. It's a very helpful insight, and glad you're on the team. We feel stronger together and grateful for your time today. We should probably let you get back to trading the market.
Thanks, David. I love being part of your organization, and whatever we can do together, I really enjoy it. Thanks for having me on today.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Be sure to send your questions to info@McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.